Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We have got a lot going on for today's show, including a great interview with local chef and restaurateur Becky Hostetter of Duos in Indianapolis. We'll be talking with Becky about the latest Duos location in the Indianapolis City Market, but we'll also get the backstory about how Essential Edibles started and ended, what came next for Becky, how the food truck craze brought her back into the restaurant biz, and her thoughts on sexism and ageism in restaurant kitchens as well. And since we're talking restaurants, we'll revisit an interview from this past summer with Eddie Somm of Somm's Place, Big Lug Canteen, and the new Somm's Ale House, and hear about how his family's restaurant empire has grown over the years and what he thinks about Indy's current restaurant scene. And then I just have to tell you what I have been up to lately. Some of you who follow me on Facebook have seen photos of the chicken coop that's gone up in our backyard this summer, and now it's just about ready for its new occupants. So I'll fill you in on our little flock of chickens and how that all came about. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Here on Eat Drink Indie Radio about what's new at the Indianapolis City Market. And one of the things Executive Director Stevie Stays Kirsch mentioned was how happy she was to finally have the restaurant Duos in the market. Duo chef and co-owner Becky Hostetter tells us today that being in the city market seems like a natural, and she fills us in on what the restaurant offers at its new city market location. But she also talks with us today about Essential Edibles, the restaurant she and her husband David opened on Mass Ave back in the 80s, how she didn't call it a vegetarian restaurant, even though it was, why people were so connected to it, what happened after it closed, and how her food always has to have heart. So let's start with the new location in the Indianapolis City Market. So tell me a little bit about that and, you know, what kind of food you have there and how it works with your other locations.
Well, it's great because at our main commissary, our main location at 29th and Meridian, we can ferret out everything and to all the other stores. So we're very fortunate in that regard. And at City Market, I'm telling you, it just feels like we landed at home. It's so nice to be in there. My dear friend Janet Schneider did the design of the space, and she had a lot of fun on Pinterest boards getting it all ready. It's just a little half of what used to be the Jumbo's space.
Right.
And we opened up with four items, just bowls, making it simple initially, and we'll just start playing around. We already, sadly, we introduced rustic chicken pie when it turned out to be the last two horribly hot weeks of summer.
Oh, my goodness.
But that's okay. We'll just bring it back. And we're doing also this week a Mauritian dish that's called gâteau piment, which is made with chickpea fritters. We have little chairs there, little stools, so we can encourage people to sit and visit with us at the counter.
Oh, nice. So they can sit at the counter and enjoy their bowl of whatever it is.
Yeah, we have a balance bowl, spring roll bowl, Becky's bowl, and what's our other bowl? We have four bowls. What's my, you know?
Well, the balance bowl is one that people might know a lot. Tell me what's in a bowl when someone orders this.
Yeah, so in a balance bowl, you get raw veggies, spinach, green onion, red bell pepper, organic brown rice, black beans. Nestor cooks the black beans perfectly every time. And then hard-boiled farm egg from Jerry Lambright's farm down by Fisher Farm in southern Indiana. And you get a little chipotle aioli, but we can do it vegan. You can get it with tofu. You can get it with chicken. You can get it with avocado. So we try to, you know, handle all that. It's gluten-free. I've spent my whole career cooking for people with special, literally for 40 years, special needs. So hopefully we've got everybody covered at all our places, but at the City Market.
Well, now, so explain the name Duos. It's not just vegetarian food. It's not just meat-friendly food. It's a combination.
So our partner is John Garnier. My husband and I have a partner, John, and he worked with us we've been friends for many, many years, and he worked at our old restaurant with us at Essential Edibles, and he's a heavy carnivore. I mean, he's an omnivore. He's classically trained chef. He worked at Glass Chimney with Dieter and Gabe for a long time, and so he brings the meat side. I'm the veg side, so hence the name Duos, and our little logo is a little bit like a yin-yang sign.
So you have it all, right?
Yeah, so everything, and we try to have this realm of comfort food and food that's going to push you to experiment and try something you generally wouldn't. And we're also, you know, part of our whole mission is to have good food that's accessible at a price that's affordable. So it's a very interesting model to try and carry out, trying to support farmers and bring that to people, but we can't charge $25 a person. So,
well, I'm sure it's a challenge, but one that you have, you bring a lot of experience to that challenge. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners probably remember Essential Edibles, like you mentioned. So let's go back to those days. Tell me a little bit about how that came about and what the local food culture was like then.
Well, Essential Edibles, you know, I'm trying to think. I don't even remember what year we opened Essential Edibles, but the way it started was I started having a little market on my street in Cottage Home neighborhood. And I went on a Saturday morning. I had an organic farmer come in. This is 34 years ago. And I would bake baguettes, and eventually, I started cooking a little bit for people. That's all I've ever done my whole career. And we found this place, a basement of an old Catholic girls' school at 429 East Vermont, and started catering and doing meals for people like who owned retail businesses or teachers who couldn't get away, mm-hmm. and taking it to them. And one day, somebody just waddled downstairs and said, "Can I get lunch here?" And that is really how it started. And we were in business for 10 years. It was all vegetarian. People have a lot of fondness and a romantic notion about it. We were terrible business people. We basically cannibalized ourselves from a financial standpoint, but we had a lot of heart. And, you know, you could go into the dining room at any day and see, you know, the governor and then the head of the Republican Party. And, you know, it was a good mix of folks. We felt very proud and good about it. And so it lasted for 10 years, which was good for people that had no idea what they were doing. And and back then, you know, there were, you know, the food scene was very... Well, there were people, Peter George.
Well, this
and
was in
Fletcher.
The 80s, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Fletcher Boyd and
so it was starting, Drew
and
it was
Susan
starting
Goss.
To change.
Drew it was and starting Susan to Goss, it uh-huh. was starting to change, and the movement for urbanizing, repopulating downtown was happening. But we also knew a lot of folks, and I think that, I mean, I would get on the phone and say, "Wake up and come support us." And I had no shame. I
really?
Mean, yo, did it all the time.
Oh, my goodness.
All the time, yeah.
Well, what was the reaction to a vegetarian restaurant in a meat and potatoes town?
Yeah. We didn't. And everybody said you couldn't do it. everybody. But I never advertised it. I never promoted it that way. I never said it was vegetarian. And
oh, that's interesting.
I do remember Evan By, somebody accidentally served him a vegan carrot cake. I don't think he was that fond of that. But so I think that was a good strategy for back then. And I would tell people if they saw something that had tofu on the menu, I still to this day do this. I say, if you are cynical about that, let me just give you a bite and I'll give you anything else you want free if you don't like this. I mean, I'm confident about it. So it was a challenge, but it was rewarding. It was really fun to, you know, because back then, and I've been a vegetarian since, you know, 73, 3. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, when all you could do is get a salad bar at Victoria Station.
Oh, my goodness.
Or a pasta. I mean, literally, that was it. And so, you know, the evolution has been so much fun to be a part of. I feel honored, you know, every day I feel honored to be a part of it.
Well, people do have very fond memories of essential edibles. People, I'm sure, still ask you about that.
No air conditioning.
Right.
Yeah, right.
What was it that made people so fond of it?
I mean, I think what was in a wacky place. We had some cool special events. We did brunches and special dinners, and we had a beautiful courtyard there, and it was a very nice place to dine. But I think that the human connection, I can't say enough about feeling connected to your guests and your customer and your community who is there. And for anybody going into the restaurant, I really highly recommend being connected, because that's the thread, besides the quality of your product, that keeps everybody coming back. You know, at our place right now at Duos, we have a cashier, Ann Sweeney. She also lives in my neighborhood, and we've been friends for 35 years. She knows everyone's name. Everybody knows her. She knows so many things about every person. And that is the sort of unspoken part of making something magic and making it work. I think it's really critical.
The hospitality of it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And that's something that I think can make a so-so meal better. You know?
Yeah, it's true.
You know, is that feeling, and it can make a wonderful meal, and if you don't have that, it can, even the best meal isn't that great if you don't have that hospitable feeling.
Well, you don't even want to bother. It's you know, we're lacking it in our lives anyway when you see everyone going down the street with earbuds on. You know, we're missing an opportunity for human connection. And I feel that they just go hand in hand. Your food, the quality, the heart that you put into it. I mean, anytime we do an event, and maybe it's somebody, we're catering an event for somebody with a low budget, I just feel that doesn't matter, that they have to have as beautiful a dish as anyone who's got a high budget. You have to put that heart into it. And I think that comes through.
We've been talking with chef and restaurateur Becky Hostetter of Duos in Indianapolis. We'll be right back with more from Becky here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back today talking with chef and restaurateur Becky Hostetter of Duos in Indianapolis about her career in the food business, which has included the much-loved former restaurant Essential Edibles. But after that restaurant closed, and after a decade-long stint as a private chef, Becky started looking at something new, a food truck. She tells us how the Duos food trailer came about, but we also talk about some current issues in the food business, about sexism and ageism, and about appreciating the effort that's gone into making today's food scene what it is. Eventually, you closed the restaurant and went and did something else.
Yeah, I private chefed for 12 years for one family, and it was really a beautiful way to find a place to land after I had a lot of shame and grief. I'd love to talk to other restaurant people that go through that. Well, I mean, to be honest with you, it was very painful to lose the restaurant, and this was a way that I could still be cooking and keep connected, but it gave me a soft place to land for a long time. And the family was super great to me and kind and generous and supportive. So it was handy dandy. I don't think they were happy when I said I was leaving. They were hoping I'd join full time, but I was ready to do my own thing.
Well, talk a little bit about your inspiration for doing something different. And I think it had to do with the food truck sort of culture that started here.
And it's goofy, too, because I'm so bad with years. But 7 or 8 years ago, I had been to India and I've been to Mexico. And I love I've always loved the idea of street food and food that's accessible to everybody. I mean, that's the whole realm when you have street food. And I thought, well, it'd be so great if I could just have a little truck and, you know, change and do the food that I want. And, you know, people come and hang out. So my friend who was deputy mayor under Bart Peterson at the time, she and I and another really great guy spent so much time working on trying to change the ordinances and the variant. What do you call them?
Well, sure, because we didn't have any regulations about food trucks.
Yes, and we thought we couldn't be on the street, but it was a lie. We actually, I mean, we spent copious hours drafting this elaborate proposition, and then suddenly West Coast Tacos is just turning up on the street. I'm like, oh, hell with that. We can just get out there. So, that was a lot of 1 year of work for nothing. But we opened up Duos. We brought John on. We had a beautiful time reconnecting, and he was ready for a change. And, you know, we brought it with this idea that we'd do one vegetarian dish, one meat dish, a little soup and salad, and then change it each week. And we used a shared-use commercial kitchen at Indy's Kitchen, which was a great incubator for a new business. And I remember one of the places I wanted to set up was at the corner of Mass and College, because that's my neighborhood, basically. And we'd have Indian bedspreads and just, you know, give them to people so they could picnic over in the Indy Fringe lawn there. And, same thing. I'd just get on the phone and call people and tell them to come out. But I was determined to make that location work because I just felt that we should be there. You know, my partner was like, Becky, why'd you do this? But then we started doing big events. And after a while, we were using so many hours at Indy's Kitchen. And when the Super Bowl came to Indianapolis, we knew we were going to take up the whole refrigerator there. And I had a dear friend who I also used to chef for many, many, many years ago, who was worked at the building where we're currently residing. And he said, we need a new person in here. And I was hesitant because I'd lost a business. I didn't want to grow too much. And they made us a beautiful offer, couldn't turn down. And we moved in, got the Super Bowl done, closed down. And
that's at 29th and Meridian, in the building there near the Children's Museum.
Yeah, in the it's called Historic Square. It's the International Medical Group building. It takes up the whole, it's giant.
It takes up the whole block just about. But you go in there and then you see, oh, there's your cafeteria space.
It's funky and great. There's a lot of light and that's very nice. And it's, we prefer to have funky places that are hard to get to. You can't park. You can't find it. That's our MO.
Well,
that's how we like it.
Like the one over at Eskenazi Health.
Yes.
Tell me about that cute little building.
Well, so Eskenazi Health Hospital, you know, our public hospital, beautiful, beautiful effort that everyone in the city came together to create and make happen. And they have this phenomenal common ground. It won the number one in the nation landscape architecture award when it was done. So if you guys have never been out there, it's stunning. And I was approached by Mr. Matt Gutwein, who said that they wanted to build a little space out there. And would we be game? Again, I was shaky, nervous. I don't think so. And they were very helpful. We really worked hard to get a plan, and they built this beautiful little glass building with a green roof in a green space with all kinds of healing and goodness. And that's where we are. You need to ride a bike over there. That's the best way. Or you can park in the garage for half an hour free. That's about enough time.
So it kind of fits your, like you said, your sort of funky space kind of designs there.
Yes.
So how has it been being a vegetarian and being a chef again, you know, like we said, in such a meat and potatoes kind of town?
I just see it as a challenge. I mean, I really do hear a lot like, well, Indy only wanted, especially back in the 80s, Indy only wants chains. And something in me just never felt that that's all the way true. If you know how to reach out to people, if you make something beautiful, then you can people will come. I don't know. It's been a really cool evolution in our city, and I'm really proud of our community and the other chefs. And you know, we've got a lot of good folks trying really hard to, you know, push the button, make something creative, interesting. They're willing to try things. I'm just grateful. I think if you were in Portland, Oregon, everybody's doing everything. Here, you can be a big fish in a small pond. And I've always felt that here, that with the right personality, product, and communication, I think it's a way to make it happen. But it's been very cool.
You can have an impact.
Yeah.
And you certainly have. But has it been a challenge being in such a male-dominated industry?
Well, now you're going to get me started in another old realm. I would say, there are a million times when a salesman will come in to my restaurant, our restaurant, because, I got a bunch of guys with me, but and say, is he here your chef? And I will, he's just asking for trouble. I will say, yeah, she is right here in front of you. And then I'll give them a little lecture,
okay,
don't make
right.
any suppositions. It's not very good for your sales. I do feel it's been, I think that earlier on, I think that I felt a little dismissed. I don't feel that way anymore, and I'm so proud of the women in our community who are bold and brave and coming forward, and I think everybody's being good about being embraced in that regard. I do also have an issue, as you know, Jolene, with ageism. And
now,
ageism...
That is an issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm 63. And I know I don't look it, but I am. I'm grandmother of six. But, I find it very interesting that people are tagging on to just youth messaging in culinary field. You see it in every magazine.
Yes.
I mean, look through a magazine. Also, not lots of people of color, which I take issue with.
Right, which is another issue
another
in the industry.
Whole thing. Yes, it is. It is. I think that it's important to pay homage and understand all the work that went into building this community or any culinary community prior to your arrival, whomever you are. I think that there's, and I live in a downtown community. It took a lot of work. I bought my house for $500, and now they're selling for $600. So I just want all those people to know, a lot of folks did a lot of work to make it so you have a good place to live, and it still takes a lot of work. And that's the way it should be for everybody. Don't, go to, we have a wealth of amazing people that have done amazing things from way back in the day.
Back in the day,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, take somebody like Claudette Einhorn. She's I just worship her. She's an amazing caterer, amazing chef, brilliant woman. She gave so much to this community from a culinary standpoint. And there are lots and lots of folks. I even go back to, in my grade school, she just died last year. She was 100 years old. My grade school lunch lady.
Oh, my goodness.
Theo Stillions. And she made everything from scratch, noodles, pies, everything. And, I've just held her in my heart all these years. She held all her recipes, by the way. Never let anyone have them.
We're talking today with chef and restaurateur Becky Hostetter of Duos in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more from Becky here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with Chef Becky Hostetter of Duos in Indianapolis, which she owns along with her husband David and Chef John Garnier as well. We talk with Becky about kitchen culture and changes she's seen during her career, issues facing the industry, about passion for the business, and how she got started cooking in the first place.
This is sort of perceived as a young person's game.
It is.
Do you see that changing? I know it's an issue. Do you see?
No, I don't. I don't have an answer for it as well. But I do think you know, that's also, even from a staffing, you know, we have a difficulty in our restaurant business all over, but in Indianapolis in particular, our the pool of employees and skilled people is tricky. If you need to staff your kitchen, it is very difficult right now. And, you know, you can take somebody who might have been retired in another field, but also raised a family, and they know, you know, they're looking for something cool to do. Consider hiring, you know, it's not necessarily the person that's gone through culinary school with a big giant ego. You take somebody who just knows how to run a family and put them in your kitchen. I mean, things like that, simple things like that that can make a difference and have an impact and bring a really valuable person to your establishment. I don't know that. And I just think from a lauding point of view and all the accolades, you know, are generally given to young people, but
particularly young men.
Oh, yes. Yes. It's getting better. And we have this lovely group, and you and I are part of it. And it's, you know, Indie Women in Food, and just trying to feel our way, what kinds of ways we can impact and create and generate and celebrate.
Exactly. More ideas, different ideas, a wide range,
yeah,
you know,
cast
of ideas.
The net out there.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, we hear a lot about kitchen culture, mm-hmm. and is it something you would recommend to some of these young women who are coming up in the business, or anybody in general?
I think there's still a battle to fight in kitchen culture, most definitely, and people have to be called out when they're when there's a lot of sexism going on. I'm not afraid to do that, even in my own kitchen. I think that also something I've noticed changing is, I think it's really valuable to pool from the cultural and ancestral heritage of other people that work in your business and bring that on board. I think that that's, I don't know, at least in my restaurants,
well, how,
I have somebody
so?
From Mexico, uh-huh. who knows they have an amazing family recipe, or, you know, a couple of years ago, I had some Mauritian folks from that stay with us, and, you know, using that person's knowledge, she came and cooked with us. And so not having an ego, in a sense, that you can open up to what other people in your kitchen have to offer or can share with you. But I think that from a respect position, I think we're still got a lot of those battles to fight and go through. But it's okay. Do it with kindness and strength. And
well, what kind of chef? What kind of chef have you been over the years? Have you been a yeller?
I'm not a yeller. Although I'm going to tell you, if I catch one more cardboard box in the recycling, I'm going to have a hissy fit. I simple things. No, I'm not a yeller. I'm very much like a mom. I never throw things. Every once in a while, if I get really worked up, then I'll just make an announcement later. Please bear with me. I'm having a hard time, or something like that. I'm very, and I think that, you know, it's probably to a fault. Sometimes I'm not. I should be more confident about being strong about something. And in our kitchen, we like to train everybody to be able to kind of do everything. I don't think Anne at the register would like to go back and cook, but most everybody else, like one of our, Skyla is a second helpings graduate, and she's been with us forever. She can do every single thing. And I mean, it can be
terrific.
This morning we're like, you got to go run breakfast because Andrew's got to go wait tables at a catering gig. She's okay. Fine. She just stops. And that's how our kitchen runs. I mean, we just know that's the way it might happen. And so we like cross-training our staff a lot, and it's been very helpful for us. But some organizations need, you know, you're just the garde manger,
right.
Or, you know, you're Seuss, that's it. You know, for me, I think everybody should be, everybody can raise each person up and if they take responsibility and do the best they can in each realm. And I that's what I expect of people. So it gets me in a lot. That does get me in trouble.
Now, how did you get started in the business? Did you go to culinary school?
No.
Did you start in a kitchen somewhere?
Yeah, no. My dad was a professor at IU. We lived out in the country on 100 acres in a In fact, they were both from New York. I don't know what they were thinking. They were out of their mind. They bought a house that had no plumbing or electricity. It's true.
Oh, my goodness.
And we had an outhouse. My dad learned from all the farmers in the area, and they were both very into food. And so I cooked, and we had foreign students out all the time, because if you're an academic and you've got a place in the country, I guess that's a big deal. And so we had students and parties, and I was fascinated from ever. I studied Greek. I spoke it fluently when I was little, and I'd go to Greek students' houses and cook with them. Italian, Maria Di Bella or Maria Grazia. She was an amazing cook, and she'd come out. So and both my parents were excellent cooks, and they also we did wild harvesting and things like that. I cooked cattails and daylily. I failed it a lot. But
literally a back to the land kind of thing.
Yeah, my mom hunted. We hunted hazelnuts, wild asparagus, all of that. We did that forever, and so it was just always my passion. I would close the kitchen off, and in our kitchen we had big oak plank floors that my parents laid from our own trees, and a giant fireplace that spanned most of the width of the kitchen. And I'd close it off, and I'd write a little menu and make my family order from me.
And that's great.
Yeah, and I have a friend who I have cooked with since we were 5 years old together.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. So, did you ever, want to grow up and be, a doctor or a teacher or something like that?
No, archaeologist. That was the only other thing but now I think it would be too technical, and I don't like tedium or anything like that. I like to, everybody knows in the kitchen, if I have to stop and if I have to just chop snap green beans forever, I have to take breaks. I got to go out and visit people or do something. Yeah. So, no, I never really had a desire to do any of that except to cook. I don't know why. My mom had all Julia Child books. I watched Graham Kerr and Julia Child. I was just like a geeky kid, I guess. I don't know. That's all I've ever cared about.
Is that a good way to come up in the business? Just come up
Sure.
cooking and
yeah.
cooking in restaurants?
Sure. Except you have no business sense, but sure. Yeah. Definitely, because if you have your passion, then that's like a third of the drive right there. That's one of the, if you lose that, then I feel that I have to get away on a regular basis, and I have to so that I can get re-inspired and reinvigorated and challenged. And but I think just having a passion from when you were, whatever you do, I'm always interested. If somebody's got a passion, I love to hear about it.
Are you optimistic about the local food scene and what's happening now and sort of where Indianapolis is going?
Yes and no. Yes. I think that, and I have felt this for a very long time, I'm concerned about affordability, rents for entrepreneurs, small entrepreneurs, and people that own buildings need to be able to recoup their investment. But we also have to still foster the independent people. I think that we need more ethnic restaurants downtown. And I don't mean a chain. I want people, real people from real countries. I think that we need to, I'm very concerned about, my downtown area turning into chain restaurants and bars. I think we'll lose a lot if that path continues. And I think that the business organizations need to be mindful of that. I'm concerned about our people population, our ability to fill our pool of workers. So I think that that's really critical as well, that we are able to continually warm up for talent and, get talent here.
Oh, absolutely. Always a challenge.
Yeah.
Always a challenge. Staffing.
Staffing. Yeah, thanks. I couldn't think. I'm blah, blah, blah. I couldn't think fast enough.
Any other changes to the food scene that you would like to see, or concerns that you have, or I don't know, dreams that you have for the city?
I'd just like to see us just keep embracing diversity. I mean, I think that that's going to be the lifeblood of where all this goes, diversity in population, in our housing, in our food scene. I think that's how a city needs that. And we have to kind of be fearless and think we're that city. We can be that way. You know, when we go out to West 38th Street, where a lot of our ethnic restaurants are, how can we get some of those and support some of those amazing creative chefs and folks from other countries to come and do a place in our, you know, in our other neighborhoods and surrounding areas and downtown. But I think I see a very supportive community here, and it feels all warm and fuzzy. It's not without struggles. This has been a rough year for a lot of folks.
And we've seen a lot of closings.
Yeah, a lot of closings and a lot of openings. It is an odd bird, Indianapolis. But I have faith in us as a city.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for talking with us about this today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a ton of fun.
We've been talking today with Indianapolis chef and restaurateur Becky Hostetter of Duos in Indianapolis, now with three locations at 29th and Meridian, at Eskenazi Hill, and now at the City Market. For more information, check out duosindy.com. Restaurateur Eddie Somm grew up in the business. Indianapolis residents have been going to the Somm's family of restaurants that his dad, Ed Somm, started for more than 30 years now, and the restaurant group continues to grow. I sat down with Eddie on the patio outside of Big Lug Canteen and the new Somm's Ale House, situated right on the Monon Trail in Nora, to talk about the history of Somm's restaurants, those famous coffee cakes, and how he's optimistic about the future of Indy's dining scene.
Somm started in 1986, so it was the year before I was born, right? So my dad had a lot going on in about 1987. Yeah, so essentially my dad started in 1986. He'd been in restaurants before that. He worked at Ground Round forever, which is kind of the name a lot of people in Indianapolis know. He actually worked with Mike Cunningham, and they were together. So it was kind of funny. He became the GM. So this Indianapolis kind of, you know, mecca of restaurateurs started at Ground Round. And then from there, it was, I think, a passion, the labor of love of being at work every day, doing this thing, making his own bread, making the coffee cakes, which everyone knows about, right?
Those coffee cakes, right?
Those coffee cakes. They pay the bills. Seriously, you know, some got to pay the bills. So, you know, it was doing steaks the right way, doing pastas, doing not afraid to expand your menu and give people what they wanted. And so from there, it became Somm's Place. It became The Roost. It became, hey, why don't I do breakfast? Why don't I do dinner? Why don't I do catering? Why don't, it's like, you know, he was just one of those guys who's like, if I can do it, I'll figure it out.
So you grew up in this.
I grew up in a chaotic restaurant life where if 5 cases of potatoes need to be peeled, 10-year-old Eddie was going to peel 5 cases of potatoes. That was about all I was capable of and still might be. So, yeah.
So where did it go from there? So that was back in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
And then how did it grow over the years? I mean, like you said, was it just organically?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was organically. I mean, he's really good at finding the areas that are underserved and trying to figure out a creative way of serving them. Because just because an area is underserved doesn't mean that you open up a place and it's going to be successful. But he's really good at crunching the numbers, figuring out what area really would work for the concept, and then making that concept taste really good. I mean, that's a part that a lot of people don't talk about. I mean, it's like, does it taste good? Would you go back for it? So he's got a unique skill set when it comes to that. It really is kind of crazy to listen to him. He's like, no, let's not open up a restaurant there. That sounds like it won't work. And he's like, it will work. Let me show you why. And it works. So I think from, you know, when he grew into that, it started with just the his ability to see what it could be in 10 years or 15 years. And
so it's a long game, actually.
It is, 100%. It needs to be if you want to make a career out of it, right? It can't just be 2 or 3 years. It's got to be a long game. Are people going to live there? Do they have the money? Do they have the disposable income? And do they have the time? You know, not every place does have that. So
So when we hear so much about the restaurants closing here in Indianapolis, we've had a lot of high-profile closures lately. What's your reaction to that as someone who has grown up doing this your whole life, pretty much?
I mean, it's a bummer. You don't want places to close, especially with talented people who make good food in places I go to. But you know, it's cyclical restaurants that it happens. I mean, they close and they close often. I think that good people will get back on their feet and do it again. But it's important to pay attention to people who are doing it the right way and are still open, and not forget that we're still out here, you know, trying. I don't think it's the customer's fault. I think it's our job to train customers to appreciate these things, understand why we do them, and if prices do go up, explain why they go up. And if we're doing something different, explain why we're doing it differently. You know, we got to just look at the positive things, too. I mean, it is not all closings. It's really not. There's still people who are doing creative things and here for Indianapolis and still local and been local for 35 years. So
now that is a long time in the restaurant business, mm-hmm. 35 years to stay local. I mean, that must feel pretty significant.
Yes, absolutely. And it's you know, the crazy part is it's not even really a talking point of his, of my dad's. And especially for me, I don't like to talk about it either. I don't like to sell my beer because it's local or my food because it's local. I want to sell because it's good. Being local is cool. I mean, like, I'm happy to be here. I live down the street. You know, I walk to my restaurants, which is awesome. It helps me. But just being local, I don't think is enough. I mean, you need to be really good. You need to be affordable. You need to think about how you're going to pay your bills and are you going to be open for 10 years and can you make a career out of it and have a family? I mean, those are things I think about every day, the balance of life and having a restaurant, because margins can be thin and some years can be tough. So sometimes you don't think about those things.
Well, that's another one of the problems that we hear a lot about the restaurant business, is that it is so, so hard on family life, so hard on personal life, and those tiny thin margins. But it can be, those kind of problems can be overcome, apparently.
They can, yeah. I mean, it's hard, and some weeks feel like it's impossible, but you have to find the balance. I mean, it does require a lot of work. I'm not sitting here saying that 40-hour work weeks are that achievable. But, you know, my goal is to give the customer the best possible experience and to give myself the best possible margins. And, you know, I don't want to price gouge them. I don't want them to feel like they're getting screwed over. I want them to come in and get a check in front of them where it's like, I would pay for that again. And then I have a margin in front of me that says I can live a sustainable life. And it's a really hard balance to achieve. You know, it's like you got to work at it and constantly make sacrifices towards getting to that ultimate goal. And then when you have it, it's about practicing it every day, you know, having the same systems in place to achieve that same effect. And hospitality goes a long way. Great service. I mean, people forget about great service can fix a bad meal. Good meal can't fix bad service. If you have bad service, the food can be incredible. People aren't going to come back. So those are the types of things I try to figure out on, you know, how to give the best possible experience and get the best cash value back for myself to reinvest in my restaurant, reinvest it in my life, reinvest it in my family and friends' lives. So that's the balance I'm always trying to achieve.
So despite the recent bad news with some of the, like I said, some of the closures that we've seen lately, are you still optimistic about Indianapolis' restaurant scene and the dining scene, the whole community?
Yeah, it comes down to customer training. You know, customer training sounds weird, but it is. It's we have a lot of people out there who want to spend money, and it's on different things. You know, they'll spend $500, $800 on an iPad or an iPhone, right? It's we can get them to spend money at restaurants. It just comes down to them understanding why. We are not New York. We are not Chicago. We are not L.A. I don't ever want to pretend that, you know, we're going to catch up to them or whatever. But catching up's not important. It's not. It's a different thing. It's a different vibe. So Indianapolis has a long ways to go, but not necessarily that we're behind. We can do different things. We can have fun. Big Lug for me was a different thing. It was fun. It was vibrant. It was community-driven brew pub that wasn't worried about distribution, that was focused on our own brand, not having other people's stuff. We make our own artwork. We make our own beers. We make our own food. We do stupid stuff at work. We do stupid events. Like, we're just goofy people. So, I mean, there's a long way for us to go, but I think it's about finding our own way. I mean, there's people who are doing awesome things, and we just need to support them. And sometimes places are going to fail, but that doesn't mean we should stop being creative and stop being fun and not doing new things. It's like, train your customers why they're fun and why they're new. And when they get that check in front of them, make sure they think, yeah, I would do that again.
We've been talking with Eddie Somm of Big Lug Canteen, Somm's Place, and then Somm's Ale House. We'll be right back with more here on WFYI and WFYI.org.
must have started several years ago, this idea that we were someday going to raise chickens. There's really not much else that will grow in our rocky, shady backyard. I mean, we can barely grow grass. My efforts at tomatoes have been unimpressive at best, though we've tried more than a few times in the 10 or so years we've lived here, which is pretty disappointing for me as the daughter of a man who prided himself on his backyard tomatoes. But I've resigned myself to the fact that, at least until we take out a couple of old maple trees and haul in a layer of topsoil to cover what used to be a gravel driveway, the backyard gardens I envision when looking at seed catalogs in the spring just aren't going to happen. But chickens. Now that was a possibility. My daughter, then in high school and now well into college, said chickens would add to my local food cred, which likely needs a boost since I'm not growing any vegetables back there. Chickens would probably even like our gravelly grass with its dandelions and violets in the spring and all those bare patches. It's not like they could hurt it much. So chickens became something that we started talking about, referring to someday in the future, someday when we would build a coop and do the research and find out how to go about the whole chicken thing. But then another spring would come and go, and a coop never got built, and we never did the research, and so the whole chicken thing never happened. It's not like the information would have been hard to find. A Facebook group called Naptown Chickens started in 2011, and then their urban homesteading shop called Agrarian opened in our neighborhood in 2013. It eventually moved to the 54th and the Monon area, and has kind of become the area's epicenter for chicken enthusiasts. Naptown Chickens even sponsors an annual bike tour of neighborhood chicken coops, called the Tour de Coops, kind of like a home tour. And eventually, we decided to check it out. Now, this was last September, the tour's sixth year, so we got out the bikes and rode around the Meridian-Kessler neighborhood, stopping at various homes and traipsing through their backyards to look at their chicken coops, and, of course, to admire their chickens. Just the sheer variety of coops was interesting. There were small coops and large ones. Some were cobbled together from scrap lumber, and others were more elaborate. Some setups seemed more like backyard farms. Admirable, but not what I had in mind. At least a couple, though, had a disco ball or a chandelier, to keep the chickens entertained, of course. Now that's more of what I was thinking. Just a few chickens in a cool-looking coop just for the fun of it. Maybe with a chandelier. The eggs, of course, would be a plus. But still, the actual reality of raising chickens was somewhere in the future. Maybe next year, we said. And then, last Christmas, I opened a gift for my husband with a mug from Agrarian and a gift certificate for $75. That should buy some chickens, he said. And so we started talking about it for real. How many chickens we might get, what breeds would be good for egg laying and for Indiana winters, and, let's be honest, which breeds make the best pets, because that's what they'd be. If I was going to raise chickens, then they'd have names like all the rest of the critters we've adopted over the years. Now, the kids would tell you that by considering chickens, I'd be violating one of my longtime rules for pets in our household, prompted by the unfortunate school festival fish incident. And that rule was four legs and a mammal. As I told the kids every time someone said they wanted a snake or a lizard, or even if they wanted to try again with fish, nope, four legs and a mammal. I figured I knew how to manage cats and dogs and hamsters. Heck, we even have a rabbit. Of course, there was one exception when our daughter decided she just had to have a tree frog. I figured at least it had four legs. But we'd never had any sort of birds. The little dinosaur-like creatures just never seemed particularly pet-like to me. But people do seem to love their chickens. And so with that gift certificate in mind, I started researching. We eventually found a coop design we liked, and breeds we thought would be nice and hardy and friendly. And I started lurking occasionally on a wonderfully informative website, backyardchickens.com, which has 325,000 users who add about 6,000 posts each day. So there was a lot to read. This past summer, we started building the coop. Kind of an elaborate setup, but I liked its looks. I figured it'd be big enough for a few chickens, and as it turns out, it should work just fine. The coop is just about done, which is good because a month ago I brought home 3 tiny chicks, just 2 days old. Now, of course, they didn't go out into the backyard coop. They went into a plastic tub in the mudroom, situated under a light so the tiny little things would stay warm. We had 3 different breeds, a buff Orpington, a black Australorp, and an Easter Egger. Technically not a breed, but one that would lay pretty blue-green eggs. So there they were, 3 little chirpers huddling together in a plastic tub, nodding off under the light, sleeping, eating, pooping, and chirping. And growing. My gosh, do they grow fast. In just 4 weeks, our tiny balls of fluff have become little chickens that can fly up out of that plastic tub. In fact, they've outgrown the tub and are now living in a former rabbit cage. They fly up onto my lap, walk up my arms and onto my shoulders, peck at my earrings, and then flutter back down. And yes, they're becoming pets. They're fun and silly, and I don't know if they'll learn their names, but they've each got one. The first to show some personality is the biggest, Maxine, and I'm guessing she'll be at the top of the pecking order. Once Maxine was named, my husband suggested Peg and Josie for the other two, and so now we have chickens with a Steely Dan theme, named coincidentally just before Steely Dan's Walter Becker passed away. We've dubbed our little flock the Babylon Sisters, after another Steely Dan song. And so this weekend, when our box of silly chirping chickens are almost 5 weeks old, they'll get to check out their new coop. It's just about done and looks quite pretty. I hope they like it. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Becky Hostetter of Duos in Indianapolis, Eddie Somm of Somm's Place, Big Lug Canteen, and Somm's Ale House, and the Babylon Sisters, Maxine, Peg, and Josie. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie.